morning, greetings, welcome to The Dividing Line. Here we are again, lots of stuff to get to today. Might even open the phones because I have been told that there have been some people saying, when do you take phone calls again? Well, I don't know, but we'll see. It might happen, might not. It all depends on whether we can get everything done we need to get done. Topics got into. I feel a little bit behind. Don't feel quite as prepared as I'd like to. It's been a real busy morning, and didn't get in here till this little while ago. And trying to cue stuff up, and so we'll see. Always want to make the program as educational as possible. And sometimes you want to address some subjects that are just real deep. I realized I left the Coptic Gnostic Library over there. I wonder if there's some other story time with the Uncle Jimmy things we could read. There are lots of people who were really doing some funny things with the blank stuff on Twitter. And in fact, there was a classic this morning. Miller Brummett. Did you hear about the new Gnostic manuscript they found? It says, quote, in the future, theological debate against paedobaptists and credobaptists, the blank understand the scriptures correctly. End quote. I retweeted that one. That was classic. That was very good. That was very, very good. And we'll have to see what other heretical things we can read on the air. People seem to like that. I could just buy Joel Osteen. It's pretty much the same thing, but not nearly as interesting and not nearly as old, I guess. So there's that. So read it with a Joel Osteen smile. That's not really possible for me to do. I've never been to a dentist for that long, and I don't have batteries attached to my teeth, so I couldn't do that. Really. Anyway, while I was in St. Charles, I saw an article on Facebook linking to this video, and it was said, you won't hear anybody talking about this. And I sort of responded by saying, well, what do you mean? First of all, I normally don't talk about politics, but secondly, I had not even seen this. And so I said, no, I will talk about it because this was troubling. There is a video popped up last week of Judge Roy Moore being interrupted in a it looks like a campaign. He's talking about the campaign. So it looks like it's a campaign appearance. It's not. It's a church service. Now, what's going to happen is there's some protester, there's some guy that's going to start yelling, and eventually they're going to get rid of him. And the pastor of the church comes up, and I actually had just seen, sorry about this, I saw the name. It was a Baptist church. It was in Alabama. What do you expect? Looked like some type of Southern Baptist church, looked like a Southern Baptist pastor. And I'm not interested in getting into the names of who it was. I don't know anything about the guy. Whatever. But what he said was very troubling to me, because he basically said, this is a worship service. This is a worship service. And if you interrupt a worship service, you'll be turned over to cops because that's illegal. Well, then why is Roy Moore up front talking about a political campaign in a worship service? That's not worship. I have, since as long as I can remember, recognized that people on the left have used liberal churches as platform for absurd campaigning and all the rest of this stuff, and just, you know, could care less about the issues raised by that. But here's the right doing exactly the same thing. Exactly the same thing. And with much less reason. I mean, liberal churches are pretty much just focused on being social justice warriors in the first place. They got nothing else to do. They don't have a gospel. They don't really believe the Bible. So why, you know. But in a, I would assume, Southern Baptist Church. Maybe somebody could look it up and verify for me that it was a Southern Baptist Church. I closed the thing and don't have time to track it back down. But assuming it was a Southern Baptist Church, or some type of a Baptist church in the South, how do you call this worship? How do you identify having a political candidate behind the pulpit speaking as part of the preaching of the service? That is not worship. If you think that's worship, then we need to have a discussion of what biblical worship is and the centrality of the presentation of God's word, the centrality of focus upon Him. You can talk about how important all these other issues are if you want to, but don't call that the worship of the eternal God. It's going to have, it's just stunning. So let's take a look at it. And I'll be honest with you, listening to his supporters was scary. He's a man's man. He's a man's man. What does that have to do with what? It was
troubling.
So let's take a look. You got it? Okay. Let's take a look at it.
Never once has anyone stated anything like it has occurred in the last 3.5 weeks.
Right. But the whole town.
That's all.
The entire town. All over the line.
Five statewide campaigns. And 3 countywide campaigns. We can stop it and get them out, or we can keep going. Let's
listen.
Five.
That's a man's man.
All right. Now that the plant is gone, with the IQ of one, I would remind everyone again that this is a worship service. And by the way, it is illegal to disturb a worship service. Now, the next one who makes disturbance will be turned over to the police. Okay. So, as pastor of this church, I'm saying we're going to do these things decently and in order.
Okay, now, decently and in order, in that context of a worship service, would have to do with an actual service of the church. This has come up a lot recently, and I want to point it out yet again. Tried to have a conversation with an individual in Twitter, had actually unblocked him because I had seen some comments he was making, and he actually made the argument. Some young, fiery, fire-breathing guy, he actually made the comment that Christian conferences are church services. And I said, well, excuse me, but isn't it rather obvious in the New Testament you have elders, you have deacons, you have the ordinances of the church, baptism and the Lord's Supper. You have the singing of psalms, you have prayers, you have the reading of scripture, you have church discipline, so you have organization. These are all things that it's very easy to identify from the epistles, from Acts. What's the issue? How can you identify a conference as a meeting of the church when you don't have anything even close to these? There's no ordinances being. This is not a worship service of the church. There's a lot of confusion as to what the quote unquote church is, but very little discussion of exactly what the Bible defines as meeting of the church. So someone in channel is saying it was Magnolia Springs Baptist Church. Is that, can someone find out if they are associated with the Southern Baptist Convention? I'm just, or if they're independent or whatever, it doesn't matter. I just want to be accurate in the description. Because like I said, I saw it and then I went and closed that. I upgraded my OS, and every time I do that, I have my favorite Quran program is called Zecker. It just works well for me, but it runs on the old Java stuff. So every time you upgrade your OS, you have to reinstall a legacy version of Java just to run it. And so I had to close everything. And so I lost that. And I'm like, yeah, didn't have time to put it back together. And like I said, I was feeling a little rushed to try to get everything put together. So I look at this, and this is very, very concerning for me. And it should be, I think, concerning for Christians that you would have, I don't care how strongly you feel about Judge Roy Moore one way or the other, or about the issues we need to have. I mean, look at the Supreme Court. We need to have another Republican senator, and it's all about the Supreme Court and all about this type of stuff. And, okay, fine, whatever. Someone's saying not listed as an SBC church. So, okay. So it's probably just a independent Baptist church. There's plenty of those. So just your standard down South Baptist church without being part of the Southern Baptist church. So, there you go. Anyway, if anyone's wondering, I am offended that you would call a political rally, even for a conservative, a worship service. I'm offended when I see that being done on the left. I'm offended when I see that being done on the right. That's not a worship service. That's a political gathering. And it needs to be identified for what it is. And I'm not getting into... I will say this. The Roy Moore situation has reminded me once again of how little modern people tend to think in a, well, tend to think the way that my generation did. Why? A couple things here. First of all, there's something called the statute of limitations, and there's something called innocent until proven guilty. And those are not covers for bad behavior in the past. They are foundations for justice and liberty. Because when you bring something up from 40 years ago, there are no witnesses left. Memories have become corrupted over time. There's no way to do justice. And you see, modern people go, but there has to be, we have to do justice. That's why people are tearing down statues and all the rest of this. Why didn't people do that in the past? It was because they didn't care, because they just weren't as smart as modern people? No, it's because they had a Christian worldview, and they realized you won't always get justice in this life, but there is a day of justice coming. And so they knew we can make mistakes in this life. Therefore, it is vitally important to have rules, evidentiary rules, innocent until proven guilty, the proper process. Have judges, for example, who have a proper worldview to be able to function. That's where I think our system is. When I say our, I'm sorry for those of you listening outside the United States. That's why where I think the United States system is virtually in a state of collapse, is because the judiciary that is supposed to be protecting these things no longer believes in a worldview that makes sense out of these things. And so, have we not known for a long time that guilty men might get away in this life? We've always felt that that was better than the imprisoning of an innocent man. That you have to, we can do the best we can with the evidence and the situation we have here, but we always recognized there is a day of justice coming. That's why you'd put that hand on that Bible and you would swear. And you might lie through your teeth, but the point was you're not going to get away with it forever. You might get away with it for now. You might fool us. You might undercut justice in this life, but you're not going to undercut justice in eternity. there's going to be a greater judge, and he knows, and you will be judged. I can see why secularists have to throw liberty and evidentiary rules and justice in that sense out the door to get instant feelings-based justice. I want feelings-based justice. Who is that woman? I don't remember what the name was. But that woman who came straight out, when the accusations, the Matt Lauer stuff and the Weinstein and all this stuff, and Kevin Spacey and I don't know much about Hollywood other than it's burning down right now. All that kind of stuff. When there was a woman who came out and she just directly said, I would rather have dozens of innocent men's lives and careers ruined than a single perpetrator get away with it. You know why they say that? Because it all has to be done in this life. There is no afterlife in which there's going to be justice, because they don't have a God who's created this world and who sits upon a throne that's based upon justice. So you better do it now. And if innocent people got to get trashed in the process, well, hey, you know, my priorities say that's just fine. Wow. So I do look at that situation. I do not have time right now to be reading all the stuff and going into the stuff about this woman said that A, no interest, B, no time. I don't live in Alabama. Maybe if I did, I'd have to spend more time on it, but I don't. And so but it's been scary to see how people will just not let the process go. And part of it's their worldview, and part of it's the fact the process is falling apart. Because if you do not have a unbiased, constitutionally bound, honest judiciary, what's left? I don't know. I don't know what's coming. Great will be its fall. Great will be its fall. No two ways about it. If we are not exceptionally careful. Well, exceptionally careful. We're being exceptionally careful. It doesn't matter. There's a lot going on here. So anyways, I can't even name the principals and the accusers, and there's something about a yearbook, and I don't know. All I know is Roy Moore should not have been standing in front of a Baptist church talking about his politics and calling it worship. It's not worship. Don't call it worship. Just don't even go there. So, I knew as soon as somebody said that, you shouldn't be running that on your computer because it's terrible. It's the only way that program works. And it's the best Quran program I've ever run across. I don't use it in my browsers, but it's, absolutely necessary for that particular program. That's a good program. I just haven't found any others. Maybe they've come up with one now. Maybe my Muslim friends will tell me about what's new on the horizon as far as an accordance level type program. But still, the best Quran program I have is on my iPad called My Quran. That's still the best one I've found. I would like to think that there are some better ones out there. Anyways, okay, so there's that. We talked about that. I'll mention this just real quickly since they're sitting over here. It came into the office, like I said, just a little while ago, and two more volumes had arrived, so there's a total of three there. You're looking at some really expensive books, really, really expensive books there. I won't even bother to tell you what they cost, but they're very expensive. Why in the world would I have really super expensive books that have basically, no English in them whatsoever. All you've got in here is chart, page after page of nothing but charts. Oh, wow, fancy schmancy with the little zoom thing there. And then here's Risultate der Collation. Result of the collation. This is called Text und Textwert. This set is sort of the pre-computer work of the Institute in Munster, where they are collating a certain number of manuscripts at particular points of textual variation. It's the printed precursor to what is now the online databases and tools that Munster is making available to New Testament scholars to do New Testament textual study in what's called the coherence-based genealogical method. Obviously, computers are much faster than we are, and the database is much larger now than what you have here. The problem is that so far we only have access to the databases and tools for the general epistles and for Acts. And I can't be in this program forever, so I'm in looking at P45, it's great to have Acts now. And it's great to have the online tools for Acts, because a major portion of P45 is Acts. But the most important portion of P45 that I need to look at is Mark. And John is important as well. Matthew and Luke are super fragmentary in P45. So what I have here are the text and text art volumes for John and Mark. And what that will allow me to do very slowly is to do manual CBGM type studies of key textual variants in P45 to utilize this very new technology to shed some light on the textual background of P45, which is my subject to begin with. And so those just came today. For the vast majority of the human population, they would have no meaning whatsoever. I understand that. And I'm going to have to be really utilizing my best reading glasses, because that font is really small. And it's just page after page after page of tables and collation of manuscripts at particular points. But it's it's extremely useful, extremely helpful along those lines. And who knows what it will help us to dig up. But it's a whole new field. It's a whole new area. And so that's just, I realize for most people that's like really boring. But in light of what we're about to look at, it's very, very relevant. And that is, y'all can stop with the computer stuff. I don't care. If you want to get muted or something on Twitter, I don't care. I know you're geeks and you just got to do your geek thing, but, just try to control yourself on the geek thing. Uh-huh. Well, you see, I'm not even ready to go there. CBGM, coherence-based genealogical method. Maybe in a year, I might be able to put together the type of slides and graphics to try to bring a general audience along in understanding such terms as pregenealogical coherence, local stemmata, global stemmata, principles of parsimony, and everything else goes along with it. A book was published just about 3 weeks ago, came out. I think it was Dr. Wasserman and Dr. Gurry. I know it was Dr. Gurry, but I think it was Tommy Wasserman was the co-author, which is meant to be a introduction to the whole concept of CBGM. And it is just simply extremely difficult even to follow what is meant to be the most simplified possible presentation of CBGM. In fact, the primary reason that CBGM is struggling for acceptance amongst many New Testament scholars and textual critics is most people just don't understand it. It is not what I was taught in the 1980s. It does require a fair amount of mathematical analysis. The computer does a lot of it, but you still need to understand what in the world the computer is doing. And it goes against the grain of where most of us are. For example, CBGM has, for those who are using it, only established the existence of one textual group, the Byzantine. It basically says there is no such thing as Alexandrian, Western, Caesarean, doesn't exist. It basically undercuts. And I'm pretty certain now, by the way, that my initial thinking on the Tyndale House, Greek New Testament was correct. Yeah. The primary editor, the man who did almost all this work is Dirk Jungkind. And one of the strongest published criticisms of CBGM is from Dr. Jungkind. So I'm pretty confident that the Tyndale House Greek New Testament sort of represents a pushback against CBGM. But if I don't have it in here, but if the Editio Critica Major, the ECM2 specifically, but the currently being published major edition of the Greek New Testament with massive amounts of collation, which is using CBGM, which when it's finished will probably be that big easily, size-wise. Since it's using CBGM, and it looks like all the English Bible translations, are utilizing ECM, and it's going to determine what's in the NA 28's already out. So NA 29, NA 30 is all going to reflect what's coming out in ECM. I don't know how you can do serious textual critical scholarship in the New Testament and not at least minimally interact with CBGM, and if you don't accept its principles or its application, say why. So that's why I'm having to do what I'm doing with the study that I'm doing. What CBGM seems to be able to help us to do is to identify the purest streams of transmission of a text. The question is, how far back does that go? And there's still a lot of questions. There's a lot of questions. Dr. Mink in Munster is the primary individual who's developed this. And I'll just explain this one thing. I'm sorry. Most folks have probably fallen asleep already, but, let me just explain this one thing. One of the elements of CBGM is you look. If you have a simple variant where you have two possibilities and you ask the computer to look through the witnesses that you have available for that reading and when you look at the manuscripts that have reading A and then you look at the manuscripts that have reading B and you ask yourself the question, in the manuscripts that have reading A, how coherent are they in having the similar readings elsewhere? In other words, you're looking, and by the way, part of CBGM is you have to stop thinking of manuscripts, and I was even using the wrong terminology. You don't think of manuscripts, you think of witnesses, and you go, what's the difference? How do I explain this? We've known for a long time, and when I've done my presentation on New Testament text reliability, I've pointed to two minuscule manuscripts, 1739 and 1881, that we know are from the 9th, 10th centuries And yet we know they're copying second or third century documents. So that somebody hundreds and hundreds of years later is copying their exemplar is very, very old. So there's not a bunch of generations in between. And so the witness of the text in 1739 can be much older than the manuscript itself is. And you might have manuscripts that are 500 years younger. So in other words, 500 years closer to the original than 1739, and yet their witness, the text they witness, is actually much farther down the road from the originals. And so one of the things you've got to try to do is stop thinking manuscript and start thinking witness. What is the text that it gives us, and how far back does that go? So the point is, when you look at the manuscripts that have reading A in them and reading B, if the largest portion of manuscripts that have reading A, if their closest possible parent text, not manuscript, but parent text, that they could be related to, likewise has A, looks like the copyists were being very faithful. And when you compare them at other places, these manuscripts have what's called high coherence, say 95, 97%. But then you look over at B, and you have to start searching up the line to the fourth, fifth, sixth possible progenitor before you find somebody else that has the same reading. That the majority of the ones that these manuscripts are related to have reading A rather than reading B. What that tells you is, in all likelihood, the scribe made a mistake here or had an edit here, but if there's lower coherence here and higher coherence here, then that's part of the information that you want to take into making your textual critical decision. It's information we've never had before. When looking, you know, if you've been sitting there with your Nephi Allen text, you know, and you're looking at a particular variant, you know, and you're looking at just a couple lines of information, you're basically just going, well, okay, looks like Vaticanus, a few minuscules here have this, and then it's just the Byzantines, and you got D out there doing its thing, and so we go with Vaticanus. That's, you know, I mean, hopefully you've translated it, and you might go, oh, looks like maybe there's some homoeteleuton going on there, similar endings. There's some things you can look at, but we've never had this type of information before. And in the general epistles and in Acts, there's been about, I don't know, significantly maybe 70 places. I'd have to look up the numbers. I've got them around someplace where you've had a, you know, fairly significant change. What's interesting is even the application of CBGM, it's all the same text. And I can assure you, once again, once ECM is done, the big thing like that that you can't really carry around. Though, obviously, it'll be digitized eventually, and we'll all carry it around our iPhones. Though I imagine it'll be pretty expensive for a while. If you exegete that the same way you exegete the Tyndale House, same teaching. And in fact, you get down to, I think it's 85 or 87% is the number that CBGM says is statistically irrelevant now, because all manuscripts are going to agree that much. That's just the base number. And so the idea that, you know, the New Testament once used to teach something different, all the rest of that stuff, CBGM really does, from an apologetic perspective, it really does have some interesting application. It ain't ready for prime time yet. Just like that alleged first century thing of Mark wasn't ready for prime time a few years ago. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. And one of the big questions that I'm working on is, how does this relate to the earliest manuscripts? Because it doesn't really care too much about how old your manuscript is. It cares about how consistent your text is in being consistent with what you think the original, the Ausgangs text, the original text is. And what has happened, it's interesting, the Byzantine text guys aren't really sure what to do with this. Because on the one hand, it's really positive to them. Because there are a number of readings that CBGM says, hey, guess what? Byzantine text has it here over against all the earliest manuscripts. There's a couple places. I wasn't prepared to do this, but since someone asked, I could give you one particular example in the General Epistles where, I mean, up until this point, I haven't looked, but I imagine the UBS text probably gave this an A or B rating. And CBGM comes along and says, nope. The coherence is found in the Byzantine reading, and it's not found in the earliest manuscripts. So there's a number of let's see here. There's a number of particularly later Byzantine readings. The CBGM says that's got the best chance of being the original. And so a lot of the changes have come up along those lines. And so you'd think the Byzantine guys are like, woohoo, yeah, we're getting vindicated. Probably not. Because obviously there's a lot of other places where it goes, no, that's a secondary reading. And here's the reason why. There's, you know, it doesn't go back far enough. And the grounds that it gives are not the same grounds that the Byzantine text priority guys have been arguing for a very, very long time. So, you know, it gives and it takes. And so I'm not sure exactly what the final result's going to be. Acts was interesting, but Acts has its own history. Now they're getting into the Gospels. And so I think Mark is next. Once Mark comes out, now we're going to really start seeing what kind of impact CBGM is going to have. And it'll get a lot more interesting at that point.
I was just going to remark that I'm sitting here following the YouTube chat, and it is interesting to me that as you're going through this, how many people are commenting on suddenly it's all clicking in their heads. It's coming together. We got one guy who's talking about he's in the middle of studying for a nursing degree in the finals, and his inclination is to drop what he's doing and look at P45.
you need to do well on your finals there, bro.
But the point of all of it is that for all of these people, they're remarking about how it's suddenly clicking into place as to why these acronyms, why these terms, why these studies become so important.
And I haven't even started. Let me tell you something. I didn't want to do this. I'm not doing this. Please, no one say, "Oh, James White was explaining CBGM." No, I'm just. You have to have real clarity in your own thinking to be able to explain something to other people. And there are only a few people that have real clarity in their own thinking on this subject in the world right now, to be honest with you. And I'm not there yet. It's extremely complicated. That's what's turning a lot of people off to it. But we've been saying for a long time, isn't it going to be neat when we can get computers involved in helping us analyze the manuscripts? Well, did you really expect that it was just simply going to do the same thing we've been doing all along? What we can't see is the interrelationship between manuscripts that a computer can see. Because, you know, when we were trying to identify text types, that was basically the general rule was a 70% agreement in particular variants. Well, now the computer can start saying, oh, no, well, this manuscript agrees with this manuscript 97.5% of the time. And with this manuscript, 95, but this one only 82% of the time. And then it can track that through all the various variants where those manuscripts happen to contain the same material and can start popping this stuff out for you in tables. So you can actually go online, you can go to Munster, and you can start using these online sources, and you can put in, you can go to a particular variant, and there's now a specific nomenclature by which you identify variants now. You can't just simply say, well, you see there in Nessie where you've got the little circle? That doesn't work anymore. Computers don't like that. They want to be a whole lot more specific than that. And so now what you've got to do is you've got to, each word is assigned a even number, and the space between it is an odd number. And so you have to identify the variant based on giving the computer the proper information. And then what you can do, and you see, CBGM still requires editors to input based on textual critical principles. That's why some of the Byzantine guys will still say, ah, but you can put in, I think the original was this. Let's see what that does to the coherence of the witnesses. And then you can flip it and go, okay, let's see what happens when we put this as the original. And then you see what happens with the witnesses. And the computer spits all this stuff out. We couldn't do that before. And that's a good thing. It's a positive thing. I mean, CBGM is basically telling us, here's the sort of the baseline agreement of all these manuscripts. And at least on that level, from an apologetic perspective, it's like, all those people who think these manuscripts are just all over the planet, sorry, the computers even tell us you're wrong about that. But beyond that, part of the argumentation is how much light can be shed upon the history of the text by CBGM. And right now, we don't know. That's something I want to work on. That's what I have to work on. Because, see, my initial goal was to ask the question, why is the text of Mark in P45, why does it show a different textual orientation than you have in the rest of this manuscript? And can this cast a light upon the period of time immediately before P45, hence going into the second century? Once I had to address that question, now all of a sudden I've got to deal with CBGM because, well, you can't avoid it now. It is part and parcel of the New Testament textual critical area. And at first I'm like, and see, this is, I even had the book in here last time. I was going to read you these. And I'm going to resist the temptation. I'm going to resist temptation because I'm just not ready. But, one of the principles upon which CBGM is based is that scribes did their best to reproduce their manuscripts without editing. That's what it's based on. And since it can work and establish familial patterns, then that seems to be part of the outcome of all this. But the scribe of P45 has a lot of singular readings. If you've read Royce's work on it, that big of a book. There are places where the scribe of P45 engaged not in editing in the sense of changing words, but dropping what he considered to be excessive words, repetitive words. Well, does that make P45 irrelevant in a CBGM world? And I started thinking, Dr. Gurry actually suggests dropping singular readings from CBGM analysis. If we dropped singular readings from P45, would CBGM allow us to identify the textual orientation and connection of P45 and extend by that means those lines back into the second century and hence do exactly what I want to do, and that is cast light into that quote-unquote dark period. Those will help with that. It's going to take a lot of time. And to be honest with you, we're looking at debates next year. And I don't know how I'm going to do that and that, because I don't got anybody to help me with this. I don't have research assistants, nothing. This is all me, myself, and I. And as Rich will tell you, pretty much most of my DL preparation is me, myself, and I on a bike with an iPod. But you can't do this on a bike with an iPod. I can do a lot of my debate preparation, but we've already got Adnan Rashid before G3. I can tell you now that the INC folks have agreed to a debate on whether the INC is the one true church, probably in San Diego. I am well aware of the fact that Jimmy Akin has says he'd be willing to debate in San Diego as well. Michael Brown and I are working right now to arrange a debate, the two of us together, against two black Hebrew Israelites. And in the midst of all that, Yasser Qadhi and I are definitely doing round number two. And we might have a really interesting place to do it now, too, that will just drive certain people right over the cliff. But more on that later. Put that together with the Swiss Reformation and the global trip around the world, and I don't know when you sleep, to be honest with you. But I love that stuff. I love all of that, and it's hard to say no to any of it. But obviously, your prayers and support are very much needed to be able to continue to do that kind of stuff. But that's what we're looking at. So, in answer to Matthew's question on Twitter, which forced me to do stuff I wasn't going to do, thank you very much. Will CBGM allow us to determine the original autographs of the Bible? Well, no, because we don't have them. The entire principle of textual criticism is reconstructing that text to the best of our abilities in light of what we have. And so if CBGM becomes and is functioning already, but becomes generally accepted as a very important tool in the textual critic's bag, so to speak, then yes, it will assist us in increasing our confidence in the establishment of what's called that Ausgangstext, that original text. There's a lot of discussion, by the way, Eldon App and other people, as to exactly what that means. I won't get into that right now. Or will there still be work, new theories, methods, et cetera, that need to be done? There will always need to be textual critical studies being done. I know that Bart Ehrman says we're just tinkering with the original right now. But for us, it's extremely important. There will always be new discoveries. I would imagine fewer as time goes on, the farther we get from that time period, of course. But there will always be a need for textual critical studies. Will textual critics be able to do this without more earlier manuscripts? There is more to be learned from the extant manuscripts. It's one thing the CBGM, CBGM does seem to do is to increase the value of older manuscripts that were just sort of all lumped together in the past. And in fact, in NA28, there are a couple minuscule manuscripts now that are being cited regularly that were just lumped into all minuscules in NA27. Because the computers have said, hey, you know, this manuscript here, every time we make a decision as to what the original text is, it seems to be tracking right along there. So this seems to be a pretty important witness. And so along those lines, yeah, it has increased our knowledge of what we already had. You get the more manuscripts you get. And look, the CBGM databases will continue to get larger and larger as we get more and more collation in. And for a lot of folks, they don't like any of this. I mean, I can't imagine that Doug Wilson would like this in light of our debate book. I want something firm right here, right now. I don't want any of this stuff. I just can't imagine. I know that someone like Erasmus could not even begin to conceive of what CBGM is about and things like that. There just weren't enough manuscripts available to him to even contemplate such things, let alone the computer technology. But I just have to think that if those early great scholars had, you know, if we could somehow bring them up to speed in the modern period, we'd just be ecstatic, absolutely ecstatic, that we are bringing every bit of our ability to think to bear on this issue. I really think they would be really excited. So there you go. Man, I just totally blew the entire program all over the place. So there you go. But yeah, much more on that in the future, I would assume. What I eventually want to do is, for example, Gurry and Wasserman give an example of how CBGM can shed light on the textual variant at Mark 1:1, whether the Son of God is in Mark 1:1. And you go back to 2006, my debate with Shabir Ali at Biola University. Shabir brought that textual variant up. Well, it's fascinating when you apply CBGM to Mark 1:1, and you have to use that volume right there to do it, because the Mark isn't out yet in the ECM. When you apply CBGM methodology, what's interesting is the manuscripts that contain the longer reading, Son of God, have a higher genealogical coherence than the ones that do not, which suggests, does not prove, but suggests that the deletion happened more often by accident in the past than any kind of addition did. So that's, is that significant? Yeah, it's a whole new element of data that we've not had before. And is it going to be apologetically relevant? It will be. But could it be abused and misused? Yeah. So I would highly recommend to you young guys coming up. Someone in the channel asked a very good question. Is it limited Greek manuscripts? Totally. Totally. One of the limitations is it does not take into any consideration Latin, Sahidic, Bohairic, anything like that. Nothing about early church fathers, citations, all that has to be done the old-fashioned way. It has to be collated as a one witness over against these things. This is solely focused upon the Greek manuscripts themselves and does not take into consideration any versional information. Will someone come up with a way of adding that in or factoring that in the future? I'd assume so. I'm not sure how it would work. The same principles could work if you had the Latin database to work with, or if you had a Bohairic, Sahidic, Coptic, Syriac, whatever. I mean, I would assume with all of those languages, you could eventually create a CBGM style database.
Shares of General Motors rose to $42.02 today. That's an uptick of 25 cents.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much. So CBGM became GM. So I just got a report on GM stock prices because I forgot to turn my iPhone upside down. I think that's funny. Anyway, so yes, it is only Greek New Testament manuscripts there. Someone else that's the same guy. So one guy asked in Twitter and then asked the same thing in channel, and I saw it in channel and then it came up in the other. And then someone asks me, I guess I'm not watching the Marcus Rogers, Stephen Bankart's debate. Nope, I'm not. Am I?
nor do I have a whole lot of interest in doing so. So anyway, but there we go. That's great. Lots of stuff we covered there. And I will blame certain people for that. But let's, I'm going to have to change this. There we go. Should have a video coming to you now. That was pretty deep stuff. So we'll take a drink of water and let Siri have interrupted things and move us on from there. This is directly relevant, and it's going to be continuing the same topic, but not quite on the same depth, thankfully. I wanted to address presentation that was posted about, I don't know, 2 weeks ago, called The Corruption of the Old and New Testaments Explained Simply in 15 Minutes with Examples by Ijaz Ahmed. And obviously now, having taken a left turn, we won't get very far in this, but there are so many basic fundamental issues to deal with here that it could be very, very educational, again, in helping us to understand the transmission of the text, the relationship of the Old and New Testaments, the Greek Septuagint, all the things that go with that. And again, lots of stuff here that you're supposed to get in seminary. But a lot of people don't. And that means that even if you go to your pastor and ask a lot of this stuff, there's just such an emphasis in most seminaries today on promotional concepts, which is normally called evangelism, leadership classes, stuff like that, that the old core of material in regards to biblical history and where the Bible came from. If you can take a Greek class and get your Greek credit in 13 days, you sort of get the idea of what's going on today. And so we do want to address these things and hopefully can assist folks. I have had folks tell me in the past that they did get more information watching the Dividing Line than they got in Bible college or seminary on certain aspects of these things. And so some of the rest of you are just bored out of your minds, but there'll be another program and I'm sure there'll be something Calvinistically inclined to talk about somewhere down the road, I suppose. But I do want to at least get into this today. And probably go to 4 o'clock our time, so we'll go for jumbo edition today, and at least get us started on responding to this material. So let's get it started. I guess I could have queued past that. Yeah, this is an excerpt from a Christian and Muslim dialogue.
So I do have a short statement to say before we begin timing, and this would be to our. I would like to begin by saying that as a Muslim, it is my duty and responsibility to engage with our Jewish and Christian brethren in a respectful, kind, and responsible manner. Tonight, you may hear me disagree with the Old Testament and the New Testament, but please, I ask that you do not confuse these disagreements with hatred. We are gathered here today to examine and understand relationships between the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the Quran. So I will begin now, inshallah. Okay, so to begin with, just so we can get this rolling, Old Testament does not mean Torah, New Testament does not mean Injil.
Now, I want to stop right there, because this has come up recently with other Muslims who have accused me of being inconsistent, pulling the wool over people's eyes, you know, all the rest of this kind of stuff. Ijaz didn't do that, but others have. When we try to explain to non-Muslims what the Quran means when it talks about the Torah and the Injil, because the Quran does not use the term Old Testament or New Testament, Hebrew scriptures versus Greek scriptures. And I believe we are on very firm ground to, in light of the fact that Islam comes after Judaism and after Christianity, historically speaking, you can argue that the people before them were all Muslims all you want. Historically, the first people in history come out of Arabia in the mid to late 7th century in our reckoning, 1st century in yours, but and they're the first Muslims. And the Quran is not known by anyone until same time period. And so what that means is that you will assume that the author of the Quran gets everything correct, gets everything right. Obviously, it's your ultimate authority. That's your presupposition. That's not our presupposition. And if you're, since you come last, and since your text does make reference to Christians and Jews and specifically addresses them, I believe that it is absolutely necessary that you establish some kind of meaningful foundation for what the words of the Quran were supposed to mean to the people to whom they were originally addressed. Not how they've been interpreted in light of the Sunnah, in light of development of Islamic theology for hundreds of years down the road. What did those words mean to the original people to whom they were addressed? And so if you are positing a prophet living in Mecca or Medina, depending on which surah we're talking about, addressing the people of the gospel as Christians, because it says, do not say three. Who else would that be addressing? You're talking to Christians. What did they understand by the word Injil? Or are you saying that the Quran is going to use language that would not have had any meaning whatsoever to the people to whom it was addressed, that they were just empty words, not meant to actually communicate anything at all? Same thing with the Jews. Is it possible? Can you understand why it would appear to those of us who do not share your pre-commitment to the infallibility and authority of the Quran? It seems that it'd be appropriate thing to ask the question, what level of accurate knowledge did the author of the Quran have of the Hebrew scriptures and of the Christian scriptures? And when you ask that question, immediately when you see the Quran addressing the stories of the Hebrew scriptures, there is a mixture between what is canonical, what was actually a part of the Hebrew scriptures, and what was not. There are numerous stories taken as fact by the author of the Quran that are a part of Jewish lore and Jewish mysticism and that are not historical by any stretch of the imagination. But the Quran takes them in that way. And so how good was the author of the Quran's knowledge? You may say, Allah is the author of the Quran, therefore it was perfect knowledge. Okay, then you should be able to demonstrate that. We shouldn't be able to point to the Quran confusing different sources. There should be an accuracy in the use of language. But what I'm hearing from a lot of Muslims is, Allah chose not to do any of that. He didn't care enough to do those things. That's irrelevant to his purposes. It would seem to be a really strong argument, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it be a, sort of like a foundational argument for your establishment of the authority of the Quran to be able to demonstrate how an unlearned man could accurately represent the beliefs of religions that he barely had any exposure to in any serious fashion? Wouldn't that be a great apologetic argument? But you don't make that apologetic argument because it's just not the case. And so, if you say to the Alal Injil, the people of the Injil, the gospel, you should judge amongst yourselves by what's contained in your sacred scriptures, the Injil, just as you said to the people of Moses, they should judge by what's in the Torah. How are they going to understand those words? Because if you anachronistically go, well, but the author of the Quran says that the Injil was given to Jesus, not to his apostles. And so the Gospel of Matthew, the Gospel of John, that can't be what the Injil actually is. You're assuming knowledge on the part of the author of the Quran that you've never even tried to establish. If the author of the Quran distinguished between those things, then you've got a point. He doesn't. Because when the author of the Quran speaks about Jesus, he draws from all sorts of non-canonical sources about Jesus, too, that are utterly ahistorical. And I'll be honest with you, when I see you guys trying to say, well, sure, yeah, this story is also found in these Gospels that were written 300-400 years later, and I see y'all trying to push the date back as far as possible, but look, for a bunch of that stuff, you can't push it back far enough. It is clearly before Muhammad, but it doesn't go back to Jesus. It isn't it's apocryphal or Gnostic or semi-Gnostic or whatever. You know, we'd have to look at the specific citation to get real specific. But in both instances, in talking about Jesus' life, in talking about Moses, or talking about what we would call the Old Testament, the Tanakh, the Torah, the Nevi'im, the Ketuvim, the author of the Quran shows great confusion or utter carelessness. I mean, if you're going to say, oh, he knew all about that stuff, well, it shows utter carelessness in the sources that are being cited. I think that indicates ignorance on the part of a prophet in Mecca and Medina who was unlettered and hence erred in his understanding. That's what it says to me. And so when you criticize me by saying, oh, we don't see Old Testament, New Testament does not mean Torah and Injil. You are anachronistically taking modern definitions that have been developed within the evolution of Islamic Dawah today and reading them back into the Quran in such a way that what you fundamentally have to say is the people to whom these things were addressed. And there's all sorts of places where the Alal Kitab, the people of the book, sometimes it's Jews, sometimes it's Christians, sometimes it's both, are addressed by the author of the Quran. And evidently they weren't supposed to have a clue. No idea whatsoever as to what it actually meant. That turns your text into mishmash. And so that's probably not the best way to interpret your text. But something I needed to address, not so much, I mean, it's brought up right here, so I needed to address it, but it was presented by some other people in Facebook over the past couple of weeks.
We will explain that in a bit. So when we speak of corruption, we first need to understand and identify the stages of textual development. We need to distinguish between the different forms of a text because corruption does not merely start at one stage.
Now, I think it's very important that we identify what the word corruption means. Every written text until the photocopier experienced corruption. Is the Old Testament corrupted? Of course. It has textual variants. New Testament? Of course. Quran? Of course. And Ijaz has this book. He's read it. I've seen him comment on it on Facebook. So, textual variants? They're listed right here. Right here in the book. He knows this is the on a palimpsest transmission of the Quran in the first centuries. Numerous other books that we could address. It's well known that there are textual variants in the manuscripts of the Quran. Even if you don't use the palimpsests, there are textual variants. We know that. Every written document, every printed document undergoes corruption. The problem is people hear the term corruption, and many, both Christians and Muslims do this, and they assume that the word corruption means loss of the original, no longer usable as a means of communicating divine truth, etc., etc. That's not what it means. Corruption simply means that there is some kind of interruption at some point in the transmission of a text. And as long as you remember that texts are transmitted via many different avenues and channels, then, you know, I mean, there were literally thousands of manuscripts destroyed by the Romans during the persecution of Christians up till the peace of the church in AD 313. Does that mean the New Testament got lost there? No, we had thousands of manuscripts that survived, but thousands were destroyed. That would be a form of corruption. When a Roman soldier chucked someone's manuscript of the Gospel of John into a fire, that's textual corruption. That's the destruction of a witness. When Uthman ordered that anything but his version of the Quran be destroyed, that's textual corruption. No question about it. Which one's more important? Depends on how successful Uthman is. And this takes us back to the difference between the free transmission of the text, which we have in the New Testament, and the controlled transmission of the Quran. And it's also important to keep something else in mind. When you compare the Tanakh, the Torah, the Nevi'im, and the Ketuvim, with the Gospel, with the Quran, you are comparing apples and oranges amongst all three. There is a different methodology in the transmission of the Old Testament text than there is the New Testament text, and very different when it comes to the Quran. And you also have a massive age difference. Massive age difference. Let alone there isn't anything for the Quran that even comes close to a little text like the Nestle-Aland 28, let alone the ECM. So there's unfortunately, in a lot of Christian-Muslim dialogues, there's this glib comparison of these texts as if they're the same. Different sizes, different ages, different languages, multiple authors versus single authors. Far more information that we possess today about the manuscripts of the New Testament and even of the Old Testament than you have of the Quran. Lots of differences. And unfortunately, that normally gets lost, and hence a lot of the examples that are given and things like that just aren't good examples at all. So things to keep in mind. I almost feel like clapping or jumping up and down or something to wake everybody else up right now, because I know that there are exactly four people in the audience that are glued to this, and everybody else is like,
"Ugh." Can happen throughout a document's lifetime. There does not need to be an intentional, malicious act of corruption. Good people can corrupt text without realizing it. So generally, there are three stages of development for any text. You have the initial writing, which we call the orthographic text. This is when the text is first being developed. Then you have the archetypal text. That is the text where the author intends to be published. And lastly, you have the codified and canonized text, better understood as the text that is known to readers and the public. So what?
Now, this is sort of drawing from, there's been a lot of discussion over the past, well, for a long time, but especially just over the past number of decades. You heard me when I was talking about CBGM, talking about the Ausgangs text. It's appropriate to make these distinctions, but you have to realize in 99% of any work, even today, the only thing that is ever available to us is that last, is the published text. I mean, I've written over 20 books, and probably some of the earlier ones on a 1.44 floppy in the other room someplace. I might have some of the earlier forms of those books in old Ventura publisher files or something like that. Probably no way of ever reading them again. But especially when it comes to the New Testament, you know, you'll read a lot of liberals, and what they'll do is they will hypothesize about stages of development in John's gospel or something like that. They have no manuscripts. They have no hard data. It's all theory. It's all theoretical. And you can do anything you want with it. And the problem is that's how you get published. I mean, you got to come up with something new to get published. And so it's a concept that unfortunately has been greatly abused and frequently just elevates pure speculation to some level of something else. But anyways, it is something that's discussed. But when it comes to actual documentation, now you do get some insights, for example, in Hadith. I reproduced a citation in the Hadith about a section that where it was said that it was caused to be forgotten. Certain verses of the Quran caused to be forgotten. Well, that would come in this area of initial text and archetypal text and then published text. This would be what? Between initial text and archetypal text. And a supernatural intervention to remove something that was once there. That would be one way of bringing data in to look at that from that perspective. There is another religious book where because it's so new, we do get an insight into this. It's the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon. We have the 1830 Book of Mormon, but now we've got printer's manuscripts, and we actually have a way of really shining a lot of light on initial text, archetypal, published, changes, you know, those lost 116 pages. Was it 116 pages? I think it was 116. Sounds right. I think it was 116 pages, something like that. But that's obviously so modern, so recent, that it's explains why we have that kind of information. But yeah, it's out there. It's interesting stuff. Let's see a question before I get back to Ijaz here. I'm sure James talked about it somewhere, if anyone knows where, links are appreciated, but how do Muslims address the Uthman issue? They've addressed it in numerous different ways. I've gotten all sorts of different answers over the years as to Uthman and what he did and why he did it and so on and so forth. So there's actually numerous responses to that. Let us press forward here as time is short.
Learn today is that at each of these stages of textual development, both the Old and New Testaments have experienced significant and meaningful changes. So, just going to point out something.
Now, it'll be interesting to look at what Ijaz means by changes. Because what he's basically going to do is he's going to point to something well known to seminary students and people, things that we've addressed in the past here. There wasn't anything new here, but it is an area that is useful for Muslims because the vast majority of Christians, including Christian apologists, do not deal with this. And that is specifically citations of the Old Testament in the New and the issue of the difference between the Hebrew Masoretic stream, the stream of witnesses in the Greek Septuagint, and the utilization of the Greek Septuagint, where it differs from the Hebrew Masoretic in the citation between when the New Testament writers are citing the Old Testament. And so those of you who've listened to this program for a long time, you know that we've addressed this many, many times. But it is not the kind of thing that you're going to get normally. And when I preached the Hebrews, we had to deal with a couple major examples of this. And if in 5 to 10% of Christian sermons on those same texts there was any reference to this, I'd be shocked. Because there are a few things more difficult to try to deal with in the context of a sermon than this kind of subject. And it's much, much better for a classroom. It's much better for a Bible study. It's much better for a webcast. It's really, really tough in a 40-minute sermon. And so a lot of folks just never get actually exposed to it. And that's why it's useful from an Islamic perspective. But, of course, by us talking about it, we're going to try to reduce its usefulness by shining more light on it so you see what's really going on.
Yep. When Alex brought the argument about a similarity, he's focusing on the last part of a text's development. So he skipped two-thirds of the way and jumped right to the end.
Now, just looking at this, though, the only place that you're going to have actual documentable evidence is over here. You're not going to, you know, outside of something like that, you know, applying this to the Quran, the hadith about the section of the Quran that was caused to be forgotten, or some witness from an early writer that said, I used to hear Muhammad and he would recite this verse differently. That's the only way you can get back into this area at all. You certainly can't get back here at all. But when it comes to the New Testament, I can't imagine how you can even address these things from a documentable perspective. Theoretical perspective, I suppose, but not from a documentary perspective.
This is a quick chart. You have the initial text, you have the middle part, and then you have the published text. What Alex focuses on in his opening dialogue is just those three things at the end. He skipped 90% of what we should be examining, and today I'm going to be demonstrating that.
Now, this is interesting because there is an appropriate distinction to be made between examining textual variation in manuscripts and the transmission of the text as it was distributed. So getting back to the Ausgangs text, anything else, again, is going to be theoretical. It's going to be, and in this case, what he really ends up coming up with is, well, these corruptions are things where you could argue that the New Testament writers are misunderstanding the Old Testament text and not being fair with the Old Testament text. That's not the same thing as corruption. We have to be very careful with the terminology as we're using it here and use it specifically. And I think sometimes some terms got used in context they might not be best to be used in.
So This is another way to understand it, a much more elaborate form of the text. So we're just going to jump ahead here a bit quickly. So what you will learn today, at present, there is a 1,000-year or more difference in time between the age of Moses and the Old Testament that we have today. However, we do not need to argue that corruption took 1,000 years. In fact, as the Old Testament itself testifies, whatever was given to Moses could have been corrupted the moment the commandments were given to the Israelites. In Exodus chapter 28, verses 3 to 4, we read that right after the Israelites were saved by God from the Egyptians, that they were taught what God told Moses, and they affirmed that they would believe in what God said and commanded. So it says, Moses came and told the people all the Lord's words and all the decisions. All the people answered together, "We are willing to do all the words that the Lord has said." And Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. So what happened next? They knew not to worship false gods or idols. That's the end of the story. There's no need for this dialogue then. But that's not the case. The Old Testament testifies that when Moses went to receive the commandments from God, and he took too long to return to them, the Israelites immediately decided to worship a golden calf. And this is what Exodus chapter 32 verse 1 indicates. When the people saw that Moses delayed in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said to him, "Get up, make us gods that will go before us." So as you can see, you don't need 1,000 years for corruption of God's words for the Israelites.
Now, I'm running out of time, but I'll stop right there. I'm a little confused, and he's going to continue on and to basically point to the sinfulness of mankind and say mankind can be so sinful that it's obvious that he could have corrupted the scriptures. Well, I don't see that as much of an argument, to be perfectly honest with you. Muslims are just as sinful as anybody else. Doesn't that mean that the Quran could have been corrupted? I mean, Muslims believe that Allah can protect the text of the Quran. Why couldn't he protect the text given to Moses? In fact, it would seem to me that's what the author of the Quran thought in Surah 5. Again, you know, Torah to Moses, Injil to Jesus, Quran to Muhammad. It's a chain. It's sort of an exegetical thing. But just because the people entered into idolatry, why does that mean that God would allow his word to be corrupted? You accept Jesus as a Rasul of Allah, and Jesus quoted from Moses, and even to the point of holding them accountable for what was said 1,400 years later, as if 1,400 years earlier, as if God had spoken to them, and based his argument upon the tense of a verb. Seems that Jesus felt that there had been an appropriate transmission of that text sufficient to hold men accountable. So I don't see the connection. I mean, men have been sinful. What does that have to do with the corruption of the Word of God? That's not an argument. I mean, I can point to terrible things that were done in the early years after the giving of the Quran. Does that mean I would have a basis for saying the Quran has been corrupted? Just looking for some consistency at that particular point. You have raised the microphone, which means you want to say something. Before the end of the show. Well, I'm wrapping up, so what do you need to say?
Okay, well, I just wanted to remind folks, a few weeks ago I mentioned that those of you who have donated, as we get near year end, and you've been donating by check, if you have not received emails from me with your donation receipts in them on a monthly basis, that means I don't have your email address. A number of you have reached out and given me that information, but there's still a number that I do not have. And so I just want to remind folks that as we near year end and I start having to wrap up, get receipts out and get the donation records sent out, that it certainly makes life easier on me if I have your email, let alone the fact that I can send you receipts when I do receive your checks and your donations on a regular basis. And certainly At the same time, it gives you the ability to have my email address if you have questions, if you have things going on. And at the same time, as we year near end, easy for me to say, please keep in mind that we are a ministry that does have needs, and we have big things, as you mentioned in the beginning of the show, big things on the horizon. Those things cost money. There's things
that don't come about free.
No, and there's also some things that I would really like to see happen next year that we don't have any kind of a budget to do, and so they may not happen at all. But certainly, as you folks support this ministry, we try very, very hard to make every cent count, and I hope you consider us a worthy cause.
Now, you do realize that making that comment after the kind of program I just did means that there are only four people that heard it, because most of them didn't survive to this point.
Oh,
he does hear it, but I'm not really
sure. I'm seeing
a good
bit of chatter in other places. I'm seeing chatter. There are people. There's more than four listening. There's at least 10. Maybe 12.
All right. Well, I will mark that I am 4 minutes and 30 seconds into, and got 11 minutes and 22 seconds left to go, and we'll get back to it. But obviously, I'd intended to get farther, but got completely sidetracked with this big stack of data over there and the questions about it. So anyways, thanks for watching The Dividing Line. Lord willing, we'll be back next week. God bless.